every business has all the problems that you were bitten to your buddy about. Your life becomes what you basically point your attention to. So if you point it to, like, we're growing fast and we're doing great and we're, you know, hiring and we're all these great things, it just creates like a, you know, sort of a vicious cycle where things get better and better. But if all you ever do is focus on the problems, that's all that's going to happen. And it's just going to trip you up and suck the energy out of you. Your body will think your business sucks.
Welcome to Transitions, a podcast that explores the inflection points and critical moments behind the success of today's business leaders. I'm your host, Tim Ludwig. In each episode, I interview a successful founder, investor, or entrepreneurial leader and explore their lives' most critical moments. You'll hear stories of growth and resilience and find inspiration to help you navigate your own crucible moments. You can access all episodes, including transcripts, at transitionspodcast.com. In today's conversation, I sit down with Ben Landers, the former founder and CEO of Blue Corona, a leading digital marketing firm serving the home services market. Since selling the business in 2022, Ben has spent time exploring and enjoying a new chapter in his life. Our talk covers topics such as kindness, having binary passions, using data to drive results, creative problem solving, and more. Ben shares personal stories and experiences that highlight the importance of these themes in his life. We also talk about Ben's approach to business and decision-making and the lessons he learned from an influential mentor and business partner. Ben's story is one of achieving surprising success while overcoming personal struggles. It is a journey of perseverance and resilience. Please enjoy my conversation with Ben Landers. Ben, thank you for joining me. I'm really excited about the conversation today, and I think you have a lot of really interesting stories to share, and I'm ready to dig in and get after them if you're ready to go.
Ready to go, Tim. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, so I thought I'd start this episode a little bit differently than I normally do, where I usually sort of go back to the beginning of people's lives and hear a little bit about their childhood. But you had sort of sketched out a number of through lines and sort of patterns that you'd recognized in yourself and sort of the things that were commonalities to a lot of experiences. And I thought that might be a pretty interesting backdrop to sort of set the stage for things. And there's five of them that I wrote down here from your list. And I thought we'd just sort of quickly tick through them one by one, if that's all right.
Yeah. Yeah. Sounds great.
So the first one, which I absolutely love, probably because I try to be this type of person myself, is kindness. And so I wondered for you where that came from and just why you'd say that's important to you and why it's been important in your life.
You know, I would, in terms of where it came from, I mean, I think I noticed with my own kids that I would say, you know, everyone's born with sort of a disposition. I mean, I think some of it, like, I take no credit for my kids being the way that they are. I give all the credit to my wife, but I do think a lot of it is just, you know, you're sort of born with that temperament. So I think there's a little bit of that, maybe a little bit of the genetic side, but my mother, you know, I think of my mom and my dad, and, you know, of course everyone has sort of critique of their parents and, you know, things that their parents did, you know, that left them with emotional baggage or scars. But my mom, you know, my mom was a teacher before, you know, when my parents were newly married. She was a teacher, you know, elementary school. And then throughout my childhood, she was a kindergarten teacher for a Catholic school. And so my mom is like your prototypical world's best teacher. In fact, you know, my future business partner, I didn't really know this until right before I was interviewing with him. I worked for him before he became my partner. My mom had taught two of his kids, and he thought my mom was so great that I literally almost thought, like, oh, this is a layup. You know, he thinks I'm, like, you know, can do no wrong because of her. So I think a big part of it comes from my mom. And then my dad, you know, my dad, we joke around, has a lot of sort of peculiarities, but he is, you know, one of the nicest guys. You know, someone would cut him off in traffic when we were kids, and he never lost his temper. You know, the guys when you're in the city that come up and, you know, start washing your windows when you're kind of saying, no, 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 you're like, you know, I'm good. My dad would always let those guys do their thing and tip them. So he's just always very kind. In fact, the one place where I always thought my parents, you know, I thought from a business standpoint, you know, where that they almost took it too far was like my parents were not the type that would ever, you know, if you ordered a sandwich and you said no onions and it came with onions, they were picking them off. and eating it. They would never, you know, send it back or make a fuss about it. And so, you know, I think as I got into, you know, sort of the business world, being assertive was like sort of hard for me. I went to buy a car, and I'll sort of end here. I went to buy a car and my dad went with me. It was the first car that I really like was negotiating to buy on my own. And my dad was so uncomfortable with me pushing back on the sales guy in terms of like the price that my dad left the dealership, just stood up in the middle of it and left. And the guy goes, there goes your ride. You know, so you have to buy something. I'm like, I'll take a cab home before I pay that, you know, for this car. My dad got home and he said, I've never been more embarrassed, you know, in my life. So that I think my parents are kind to a fault. And a lot of that is, you know, kind of in my core. I have to fight against it when I think it's in my, you know, benefit, you know, from a business standpoint.
There are worse things to have to fight against in life, I think.
Absolutely. I totally recognize that.
Yeah. And it sounds like the apple did not fall far from the tree in terms of where it comes from in you. The next one on your list was binary passions. And this one, if you need a reminder, I'll explain what you meant by it, at least my understanding of it. But it might take a little explanation for, I think, the listener to understand what you mean by that.
Well, I mean, I think, again, going back to like temperament as a kid, you know, I guess I could probably be described as like ADHD. You know, I was all over the place. But, you know, when I would get into something, I was all in. You know, our employees made a video once for like, you know, it was like Boss's Appreciation Day or something that they should never have been like celebrating. But they made this video to surprise me. And the through line of that was like when the employees were being interviewed, like, how would you describe Ben? How would you describe Ben? How would you describe Ben? Every single one of them was like passionate, you know, super passionate. So when I get into something, whether it was like business or, you know, I was into cycling growing up, whenever I get into a topic, I really am it's all in, you know, 100%. It's very hard to sort of turn it off. And, you know, I'm sure we'll get to this later, but that's been one of the challenges with sort of, you know, where I've ended up is it's, you know, it's like when people say like, you know, hey, do you think you'll start something new, you know, another career? I think there is a part of me recognizing that it's hard for me to sort of, you know, take it gradually, that I kind of feel like I better be really careful with what I, you know, kind of set out to do, because it could become like a snowball that's just run away, you know?
Yeah, my son is a bit like that, where when he's interested in something, the intensity and focus is extreme. And if he isn't, there's nothing that you could do or I could do to persuade him or cajole him or force him to manifest some motivation to get into it. Sounds like that's sort of been your experience in a lot of life as well.
Yeah. I mean, of course, with age, you know, you start to, I think one of the things that I've gotten much better, you know, from when I was a kid was sort of coming up with little tricks to get myself into something that I'm not, you know, typically into. Whereas when I was a kid, it was hopeless. So
What are some of those tricks?
Well, like, I mean, this is a really like, probably isn't a great one, but you know, when I was starting the business, you know, I hated, you know, sort of the administrivia, you know, it's like building the spreadsheet to sort of keep an eye on the business. Or there were so many like routine tasks, but my business partner, one of the things that he imparted on me was sort of the whole, like, you can expect what you inspect. So like, if you're not looking at the accounts receivable, and this is when we were really small, you know, if you're not looking at the account receivable, you can expect it to be screwed up and you're going to have some bad account and we're going to lose a bunch of money because you weren't watching the, you know, the thing. So, you know, so inevitably, you know, I had a small team at that point and would assign some of these things out, but, you know, I had to sort of run the traps and check to make sure they were doing it. And, you know, turning it into like a little bit of a game, you know, or like, so I'm a morning person. So when we had the business, I was getting up at like, you know, 4:15, 4:30 in the morning, no alarm. I was the first one in line at the Starbucks, which opened at like 5. And then I would be at my desk and then I would come in and I would sort of do this, like running the traps of the business before anyone got there, with a huge, you know, venti, you know, black eye or red eye or whatever I was drinking at the time. Something that's terrible for you, I'm sure. It's sort of making a game out of it, you know, that's one thing. And another thing was my wife was big on like going to church, going to mass when the kids were small, going to church. And even though I grew up the son of a Catholic school teacher, you know, I hated going to church. I never got anything out of it. You know, it was just, every minute was like an hour. But, you know, it was really important to my wife. And so it was like, all right, you know, it's an hour, you know, out of my week. I can come up with this. So I remember bringing like a little field notes thing. First of all, we sat then in the front row. I was like, my mom sat us in the back because we were bad kids. I'm like, I think it works the opposite. We stick them in the front row. And when our son starts to goof off, like the priest is right there, you know? So, and that was like a big difference, but it also worked for me because, you know, the guy is like looking at you in the eye while he's giving some, you know, homily. And then I would try to find things that related back to the business and just sort of general leadership, you know, lessons, which there were some times where that didn't work. And I was like, my eyelids, I had to like, you know, put nails to keep them up. And, you know, sometimes I would play games with my son, you know, in the pew and just basically it's like him and I hanging out, you know, making that hour go by. But when I was a kid, I'm sure my mom put us at the back because we were probably, you know, just all over the, I had two younger brothers. And so it was probably like punching each other, you know, in the pew.
Right. You guys were getting squirrely and she needed to keep you sort of hidden from the rest of the congregation. Correct. And maybe ready for a fast exit.
Correct. I remember having to take my son was having a tantrum once, you know, we're in like the second or third row as far up as we could get. And he's having a nuclear meltdown while the priest is giving this homily. And I'm picking him up and he's doing the thing where he's like flailing and kicking. And the priest says something like, you know, everyone say a prayer for that dad. You know, that guy's having a rough time. I literally was walking out with my back going like, I cannot believe this is happening. But
that just reminded me of a time when my daughter was little and she's been really obstinate and stubborn since the moment she was born. And we were in a mall one time and shopping in a store and she started to have a meltdown. And so I grabbed her and took her outside and she just wasn't stopping. And so I knew that this was hopeless. So I just put her down and then she's lying on the ground outside this mall with people walking by screaming. And every time I would go to touch her, she would rise up and say, "Don't hurt me. Stop touching me."
Yeah. And you're in California. That's like, you know, you've got to be careful. Someone could have like, right, I was, you know, come to arrest you.
That's right. I was waiting for CPS to be called.
That's right.
Next one on the list here is using data to drive results. When did you first discover that you enjoyed using the data? And then what are some of the ways that you've found that you've been able to use it both personally and professionally?
Yeah, I mean, I first discovered it cycling, bicycle racing. When I was a kid, I got into bike racing and had sort of a knack for all endurance sports, running, swimming, cycling. I was sort of naturally good at all three, but I really took to the cycling. And I don't know how I got this because, again, I grew up kind of middle, you know, upper middle class, had to, you know, mow lawns for my first mountain bike, you know, which was not a super fancy bike. But I got one of the early Polar heart rate monitors, you know, where it was like this gigantic watch and you kind of just put it around this big piece of foam on your handlebar of your mountain bike. And I remember even back then, like all my sort of friends, you know, who were a lot of kids, but we also trained and rode with adults, you know, kind of saying like, what is that? You know, that's so goofy, you know, looking, but, you know, sort of this, you know, back then everyone would say, you know, sort of 220 minus your age was this kind of standard formula for like what your max heart rate was. And then you did all your training zones based on a percentage of that. Well, you know, I get this heart rate monitor and immediately notice that I can't get my heart rate over 194, you know, beats. And I'm like 14 years old. And so I, of course, think, oh, something must be wrong with me. But, you know, I'm really good. So, you know, does it matter? And I remember my physician saying, you know, who's like a runner who was saying, oh, that formula is complete BS. You know, it's like it gives you a rough idea. And so, you know, some people that were trying to train in their zones, you know, and again, some people like stop at the top of a hill and like try to take their heart rate for 6 seconds and then like extrapolate out how many beats a minute it was. I had the data and then sort of knowing like, hey, I don't need to be trying to get my heart rate up this high. My, you know, 70% of my max or whatever is like way down here. And then later, but not that much later, I got a power meter, you know, cycling is a really interesting sport in that, you know, like with swimming and things like that, it's, you know, can be harder to quantify, you know, or maybe swimming and running are pretty easy, but as well. But with cycling, these power meters, it's measuring the exact output, you know, at the crank. And so I was an early adopter of a power meter and, you know, use that to basically do all these things that at the time for amateur cyclists, I'm sure the professionals were already doing this, but like I would go out with my friends for a ride and I'm in the DC area, which is like rolling hills. And so what everyone does when they train around here is they like hammer up every hill, they go fast up every hill, and then they basically just coast down the descent to the next hill. So the power output is just up, down, up, down, up, down. And we're talking like extremely up and then zero. Extremely up and then zero. And so when I got the power meter, it sort of coincided when I had gotten a job where all of a sudden the job is taking all this time that I used to spend training. And it's like, how am I going to be as good as I was when I now can't train as much? And the answer in part to that was training smarter, you know, using the data. So like if I wanted to do an aerobic ride, I would ride maybe at like 200 to 230 watts. But that meant going like almost walking speed up the climb and then hammering down the descent to try to keep the wattage steady. And as a result, you'd spend like 5 hours in this aerobic zone as opposed to, you know, a minute at like your anaerobic, you know, above, you know, where you're not even using oxygen, and then zero output, you know, and basically training a myriad of your body's systems as opposed to really focusing on one with the data. Another just personal example of using data was when I was in college, you know, maybe like a lot of people, I stopped cycling in college. I went to Ohio University, which was a big party school. I don't want my kids necessarily to hear this, but I think they know I had a fake ID when I was, you know, 19. And so I could go into all the bars and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And so I went from like 160 pounds when I went to college to like 225. 230 in 4-ish years. And so
that's a big difference. That'll slow you down on the bike.
Yeah, I wasn't riding at the time, so I wouldn't even have appreciated that. But my fifth year of college, I decided, you know, I was going to lose weight and I was going to run the Athens half marathon. You know, I decided I was going to lose weight maybe in like, you know, September, October, August when I went back to school. Athens half marathon was like in May, you know, the next year. I had a computer. Most people would go to the computer lab. This was, you know, 1998, 99, some around there. But I had bought my roommate's computer. He was like in financial trouble and he sold me a desktop computer. And I found this app called Diet Power. And it was essentially, you know, everyone now has like MyFitnessPal and Lose It, you know, all these apps that they're on their phone. But I used this program called Diet Power and I entered every single thing that I ate. I measured everything. I weighed everything. Most of my friends had graduated. So I was in my fifth year. It made this a lot easier. But I essentially went on like a super low calorie, you know, diet. And, you know, one of the discoveries, of course, is, you know, everyone eyeballs stuff, you know, so they're like, oh, I had chicken breast and, you know, some rice, or, you know, I had a peanut butter and jelly sandwich for lunch. That's not that many calories. And it's like, if you weigh the peanut butter that you're putting on the sandwich, for most like college guys, it's like 4 servings, not one. And, you know, and so once you see that awareness that the data, you know, provides you, it's like, oh my gosh, you know, like I remember going to the bars where I would have like a little business card, like an index card, and I would put 1 through 6, sometimes 1 through 8. And every time I'd have a beer, I would tear a number off because, of course, like after 4 or 5, it's like, I don't know how many I had. So I had 3 beers last night. Well, 3 and 6 is like quite a big difference when you're trying to lose weight. And the business side of things, our entire business was built on this idea that most small, medium-sized businesses do not accurately track their advertising and marketing, the results. They don't know what's working. They follow other business owners. They ask buddies in business groups. The sales rep is cute, you know, so they spend more money. It's like the most idiotic things ever. And our whole business was sort of based on this idea that if you actually tracked as best you could all your advertising marketing, what you would see would just blow you away and cause you to cut certain things that you've been doing forever and maybe try some new things just Because if you know you're going to see whether it works or it doesn't, it's easier to spend a couple $1,000s than where you feel like you're just, you know, throwing it into a black hole.
Yeah. So with all this data, I wonder for you, Ben, what role does intuition or gut feel play in your decision making?
Well, I feel like there's a, you know, my whole life is like this big, you know, sort of, you know, paradox, and maybe everyone is this way, which is, you know, with the cycling, it was sort of an exception. I mean, I was very much into the data and sort of, I wouldn't say I followed it sort of dogmatically, but I really, there wasn't a whole lot of like, if I felt tired, but I could produce the power, I did the workout. In business, I was much more torn. Like my business partner was sort of really the one. And when I met him, he owned another company, owned a bottled water delivery company in the DC area. I met him while I was cycling, I think. And he was all about, he was an engineer and a finance guy, and he was sort of all about the data and tracking. I was when I met him, before I started to work for him, I was selling advertising that really was almost impossible to quantify. I was selling sponsorships to amateur participatory athletic events like, you know, Chicago Marathon, Baltimore Marathon, selling the title, you know, sponsorship of those things. So like, how are you really going to quantify what LaSalle Bank gets from sponsoring the Chicago Marathon? I mean, I don't even know if LaSalle Bank's still in business, which, you know, maybe that shows you how well that advertising works. I don't know. But so I there was always this sort of like, you know, this where you get torn, where like you can't quantify that something is working. Like, I guess one good example, like when we started the company and we started doing swag, we started like buying, you know, shirts and stuff. Maybe our second or third order, we ended up getting Patagonia, you know, jackets and vests and all that stuff. And I don't remember whether it was my business partner or someone kind of saying like, you know, why would you, you know, each of those jackets is like, you know, $180. Like, why wouldn't you just get Columbia? You know, they have your logo on them, you know, that type of thing. And I was sort of saying that, you know, I don't know how you are, but like when I go to trade shows and I get like the fake Yeti or, you know, and like 2 months later, you know, you have this Yeti and like it comes delaminated from the, you know, the, so it's like a joke, or you got the pen that you put in your work travel bag that then explodes, you know, before like a meeting, and you're like, your whole bag is ruined and it's all over everything. You know, it's like you can't quantify certain things like that. But it was just, you had this feeling that if we put our brand, kind of piggyback it on, you know, this was before sort of Patagucci, you know, kids call, you know, this was like Patagonia was like, you know, quality stuff, lasts forever. So like your price per wear is like ridiculously low, and the stuff is so nice that people proudly wear it. Like the stuff that we had was really nice stuff. I'd have friends that would say like, if you get me that jacket, I'll wear it. I don't even know what Blue Krona is. So, you know, there are sort of some of those challenges. I think I continue to, Bob and I, my business partner, we used to joke around that like when we couldn't quantify something, like if we wanted to do something like when I worked for him, we did sponsor a bike race. And I told him, he said, you know, I want to know how many new accounts we get from sponsoring the race. And I set up a number of mechanisms to try to capture that, you know, enter this code on the website when you sign up and we can track it. When you call in, mention the Silver Spring Grand Prix, you know, all that stuff. But we used to joke around that, you know, anything that you couldn't quantify, or any advertising that you did that failed, you know, the analytical test, you could at least kind of rest that, you know, or like sleep at night that you got branding. You know, like there, we like throwing seeds out on the field, and some of it is germinating in places that we can't see, can't quantify, can't measure.
So you'd use data where you could, but you're also willing to not be so dogmatic about it that it would prevent you from doing things that intuitively felt right or like they were worth the gamble or the effort.
Yeah, but it definitely would cause, I mean, even as you asked the question, I got this little feeling in the pit of my stomach, which is sort of this, you know, it's, I, you know, today I I'm trying to learn more and sort of, you know, be more in, into investing and I sort of, my narrative is like, I spent all this time building a business and accumulating money. And it was just basically sitting in a, you know, in a Vanguard account, you know, like a, just no allocation of anything. And, you know, some of the, you know, I read a lot of the, you know, I listen to all the, whatever the private equity firm is that recorded all the Berkshire Hathaway annual meetings, you know, listened to all those and big Munger, you know, Buffett fan. But there are certain times where, you know, I go into like a Schwab account and, you know, like I have a bunch of buddies at one point that were working at Palantir. And I just based on who they are, how smart they are, how hard they were working, I didn't even look at any of the parameters. And I put like, you know, whatever, it's like 30 grand. I'm buy 30 grand stock just based on these guys that I know that work there and what they're saying. And I think that, you know, that was when the stock was like 18 bucks. And I'm sure some people at that time said, oh, this is like ridiculously overvalued. And, you know, they're not, you know. So, you know, I do things that defy the, you know, sort of the irrational
side of things. That's a very Peter Lynch approach to investing, by the way, it sounds like to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, HubSpot was the same. We were a HubSpot VAR when Blue Crane was very in its infancy, and all the VARs got to buy stock pre-IPO at like $25 a share. And so I bought a bunch of stock. And Bob, my business partner, said, good luck with that. You know, I think it got to 75 and I was saying to Bob, you know, look how well this has done. You know, I'm gonna buy more. And then he, as sort of a Harvard MBA finance guy, he said, I just want you to understand, like, A, they've never made any money. Company's never made any money. There's no plan to ever make money based on the stuff that I've read about them. And that stock at 75 is like Blue Corona trading or being sold for X, whatever X was. It was some ridiculous number. So, you know, I would never buy that. Like, I would never buy that company. It's way overvalued, you know, and look, you know, it's come down a little bit, but now it's close to $500 a share. So.
The next item on your list here was creative problem solving. And I just wanted to hear what sort of a quick example of this was. Sort of interesting combination of things too with the data. And then if you can be sort of analytical and rigorous about that, but then also creative, it seems like that's pretty powerful.
I think, you know, my, you know, strong suit, and I think I noticed this at a pretty early age, but, you know, like if, when you have a company, you have some challenge, you know, I don't know, customers are canceling or complaining or something's happening, and you get the team in a room, you know, in a conference room, and it's like, all right, let's brainstorm possible ways to solve this. There are always people that, like, it just can come up with like 1,000 ideas, like rapid fire. And then there are people that won't say a word no matter what. Doesn't matter who's in the room. It just, they can't, you know, get it out there. I am the former. Like, I can come up with 1,000 different ideas. And I was trying to think of an example of like, you know, creative problem solving. I'm not sure off the top of my head I could name one that I think is, you know, this is terribly creative, but certainly over the years, there have been lots of, you know, different challenges. And I feel like I've always had a very sort of out of the box, or like sort of the opposite of, you know, everyone's throwing out ideas and I say something that's sort of out of left field. And, you know, I don't know if it's, you know, I would say probably 35% of the time, you know, 40% of the time that sort of that what, the idea that was like completely out of left field, that at first everyone's like, are you kidding me? Like, they get serious. Like, this is a serious problem meeting. Probably 35 to 40% of the time that became, you know, something that we did that, you know, that ended up, you know, a big deal. I think one of the ones that, again, I don't know that this is the greatest example, and my bar for creativity has probably changed over the years. But when I was working for the bottled water company, half our customers were residential and half were commercial. So, you know, you'd have someone who had Drink More Water, that was the name of the company, at their house. And then they would work at like the FDA, you know, like, or like some government agency. And the inevitably their floor would say like, ah, oh, the DC tap water's terrible. Like, do you guys want to all pool our money together? We'll start a water club and we'll get bottled water delivered to our floor. Right. And that was like a very common thing. And we got tons of business from referrals. I mean, we tracked all of our advertising marketing and word of mouth was huge. And I remember we were trying to figure out like, how could you get people sort of in an office to sort of volunteer that they have, you know, drink more water at their home, like where their coworkers might hear it or see it. And I remember once Bob and I, the owner of the company and I, one of the drivers had broken his leg. And sort of at the last minute, I show up, you know, I'm the vice president of sales and marketing. I have nothing to do with like delivering the product. But I show up for work and Bob says, hey, grab a cup of coffee. We're going to go run a route. We're going to run Mike Mills' route. He broke his leg, can't drive. And I was like, are you kidding me? Like, this is the problem when you go work for one of these small companies. Like, you end up doing the dumbest, you know, stuff. So Bob and I are driving around. You know, I'm with the owner of the company. So it was, you know, it's kind of cool, but we're driving around and I didn't appreciate, as someone who worked on the inside, I didn't appreciate that these guys that are delivering the water, like inside the FDA, they're walking through like a maze of cubicles with hundreds of people, you know? And so I kept saying to Bob, I was like, you know, why can't we get the drivers to like pass out cards, you know, like mention my name, get $100 off. And Bob said, the guys will not do that. The guys, the water delivery driver, even if I pay them $100 in a new account, their motivation is getting all their stuff delivered by like noon so they can go home to like their girlfriend or like lift weights, like, which is ironic because these guys are lifting like 50 pound bottles all day long. Then they get off at noon and they go bodybuild or whatever. But so what we came up with was we had this kind of like the Amex Black Card. So Bob had like a Black Card. And I remember anytime he used it, people would always make a comment, you know, about it, like waiters, waitresses, that kind of thing. And so I remember thinking, like, what if we did something where when an employee of like the FDA sees the bottled water driver, they give him a card and the guy gives him like a secret, you know, code, and then they get redeem it for a prize. And, you know, that way it's not the driver doesn't have to do anything but react. Like, the drivers are all nice. If someone interrupts them, they're going to, you know, play along with it. So anyway, we got these cards made, you know, these drink more cards, and it was like a credit card type thing, blue. And it was, I don't remember the, you know, what it was called, but it had a name, you know, it was kind of like the Centurion Club, but it wasn't, you know, I didn't completely rip off, you know, Amex. And so things like that were ways that, you know, were just things that we came up with that, you know, I think were, you know, he had had the business for a long time. So it was sort of like, it's never going to work. Like, you know, it's sort of like, all right, you know, you've been here a year, you think you're full of new ideas, but that's never going to work. And that one was a big one, you know, as an example.
That's really neat. I love being in a room with people that think completely differently from me, you know, just, and I think there's people with just different levels of standard deviations apart from the norm. And this is sort of a segue into the last one, I think, but it's always really energizing to have somebody say something and it's just like, whoa, I never would have thought of it through that lens. And it wouldn't even occur to me, but it's so smart. It's just like, you know, you just blew open the walls and, you know, exposed a whole new dimension. Well,
the best is if you can marry, I think, what, you know, one of the things that I feel like I'm pretty, have a high degree of self-awareness is I know where my kind of circle of competence is, what I'm good at. Like, I'm good at coming up with kind of creative ideas and I'm good at coming up with a volume of them. What I'm not good at is winnowing it down to the best one. And so, like, I used to have a guy who worked for me named Tyler Yost, and I say this as a shout out. Tyler is like just a fantastic guy. We hired him as an account manager when we were, you know, probably had 25 or 30 employees. And it was just, he worked for Bank of America. He was a Six Sigma, you know, black belt or green belt or something. Very analytical guy. And he worked for Red Ventures before. He worked for Bank of America and then Red Ventures. And having Tyler early on, I would call Tyler when he was an account manager. And I was basically saying, hey, I'm giving you an additional job, which is like, you're almost like my, just sort of, when I go into these meetings, I need someone like you to kind of help me come up with weights, you know, for these different things. Because to me, everything is a great idea. These are all things we can execute, but I know we can't. And so I need someone who's really analytical and disciplined to essentially say, you know, you know, no. Can he would draw, he's like a consultant, he would draw all these little triangles and say, you know, all right, quality, speed, cost, you know, where, and it would always frustrate me, but I needed someone like that to help me execute.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And so the last one here is oppositional and contrarian thinking. You view it as a strength. I mean, it sounds so negative. So I think, you know, people may not understand how being oppositional or contrarian is actually something that you sort of see as a superpower. So what's the benefit in your mind to having that sort of a brain or outlook on things?
Well, and maybe I'm describing it the wrong way, but like I just, you know, on a personal example, I remember, you know, when in cycling, road cycling, I think anyone who's ever taken up road cycling kind of can't believe how hard it is to go from category 5, which is beginner, you're brand new, you just got a racing license, to category 1. Category 1 are the guys going to like the Olympic trials and stuff like that, professionals. And so I would say the vast majority of people get to like cat 4 or cat 3, and then they get stuck there. And it's just, it's extremely hard to get to move on. To get move on, you have to win a number of races and get points. And there's always like a junior or a college kid who's coming through the ranks who will be a professional. So like you would have won, but these three junior kids just, you know, took off and got all the top points. And so I remember like watching all these amateur, you know, we all had jobs and stuff, everyone trained. And everyone would say, well, you know, I don't want to peak in March. I want to peak when these big races are in like May, June, July. And so, you know, and they would use that as a justification for like why they were riding easy in December, January, and February. And I'm sitting here thinking like, we're in the DC area where the weather is horrible in the grand scheme of DC in January and February. So the last thing you want to be doing is like long, slow rides in January. So I remember thinking, why wouldn't you basically, if you're a cat 3 and you're trying to get out, why wouldn't you come out like in your absolute peak condition, March 1st, win all the early season races, upgrade. You could even take a little mini recovery, you know, in like April, May, whatever, May, and then come back for the later, you know, summer races. And like, if you're trying to peak when everyone else is also trying to peak, it's going to be impossible unless you have, you know, real talent. And if you had real talent, you wouldn't be in the cat threes for that long. And so that's exactly what I did. You know, I was like doing like the hardest possible rides in January and February. While all my friends were like, oh, you know, that's, you're going to burn out. You know, you're going to burn out. It's like, no, I'm not. We're not, we have jobs. We, you know, we can't burn out physically because we can't train enough. Things like that. Or like another was, you know, now this intermittent fasting is like a big deal. I mean, everyone knows about it, but when I was tracking my calories, you know, it was, you hear this thing where like, if you starve yourself, I should probably say this quietly, but you know, if you starve yourself, your metabolism will drop. Like everyone's heard that, but it's like, by how much and by for how long? I mean, sure, if you starve yourself for months, maybe your metabolism goes down a little bit, but you're telling me that I couldn't take a day and just have like 500 calories and then go normal, like the rest of the week, maybe do that twice, two days a week. And of course, and I did that and everyone, people were calling it the weekend Ben diet in college, where I would basically eat like a monk Monday through Friday. And then on the weekends, it was a free for all, you know, so just whatever everyone says, my gut instinct is what would happen if I did the exact opposite of what everyone says, like, eat a balanced diet. What if you didn't eat a balanced diet? What if you just ate one thing? Like what stops? We feed the dog that we love so much the same crap every day. What would happen if I just ate the same sort of balanced meals every single day and never like varied it up? You know, just stuff like that. And on the work side of things, it's the same sort of thing. When we started Blue Corona, you know, everyone said, oh, it's a digital agency. It's a digital agency. We never thought of it quite that way, but it's a digital agency. And so the natural thing is like, oh, well, you want bigger clients, like you want marquee clients, you know, go get BMW or Four Seasons or all these things. And I remember thinking like one of the best parts about the bottled water business was that we had 15,000 clients. You know, we had all these little residential accounts, which, you know, they're getting like they're paying like $50 a month. And then we would have a huge, you know, corporate account. And then we'd have all these little corporate accounts. So with rare exception, if you lost a customer, I mean, of course you wanted to keep everyone, but you could lose, someone's moving. I got to cancel, I'm moving. It's like, okay, you know, good luck in your new city. You didn't lose any sleep over it. And so I was like, why would we want to build a business where we have like BMW paying $50,000 a month, you know, paying us, having this like lumpiness, and you have to go pitch them and, you know, do a whole song and dance. Like, why wouldn't we want like hundreds of small business clients where they might be paying, you know, $1,500 a month? I mean, wouldn't that be the better business to own? You know, and like you could get junior people to do the work on those small accounts. Inevitably, you're going to get some big marquee accounts. So you'll have some experienced people. But if the experienced people get a big head and go off and quit, you probably have some talented junior people that you could move up pretty quickly. You know, just sort of these things. I remember going to, and I'll sort of end it there. I remember going to a marketing conference, and you know, I was literally sitting in a circle of people, and you know, it's like in New York City or Chicago or somewhere. And everyone is going around introducing themselves. Oh, we're a UX, UI digital agency, and we focus on luxury hotels. Or, you know, we have Victoria's Secret as our client, or Limited, or whatever. And I remember it got around to me, and the one guy in the group who knew me, I don't know why he did this. He said, like pre-introduced me. He said, "Hey, everyone, this is Ben." I think I'd walked up late. He's like, "This is Ben. His company builds websites for plumbers." And I was like, "You're such a dick. Like, why would you say that? I mean, we have other clients than plumbers. We do have a lot of plumbers, but I remember thinking, on the one hand, I was like just a touch embarrassed, you know, there's all these hoity-toity advertising people. But then I remember also thinking, we have a better business than all of you, in my opinion. And looking at some of those people that were in that group, you know, they still have, you know, a 15-person company, ebbs and flows, you know, never going to be able to sell it because they're the creative genius.
Yeah, I those are wonderful examples. And they're also examples in my mind of creative problem solving. So I think there's a strong linkage there. Let's switch gears now and maybe go back to sort of more the traditional format that I use here. And there's three topics I want to touch on. The first is you talk about there was a pretty dramatic transformation for you as a student, you know, starting probably around early middle school all the way up through college. And I'd like to unpack that a little bit more. Like what was the trajectory for that transformation? Where was the starting point? And then what was the evolution and sort of the ending point? And
I mean, it's funny when you said the trajectory, I think, you know, when I was a kid, I don't remember exactly when I started, you know, struggling with school. It was like probably around puberty, you know, like, I don't, and I've developed early. So I was like the tallest, you know, one of the tallest kids in my elementary school. And I also feel like the teachers, you know, sort of gave me initially unwanted attention because I was, you know, I was taller and sort of more developed than the other kids. But somewhere around there, I started just struggling with school, you know, hated school. You know, I think it was, you know, a combination of, you know, again, at the time, undiagnosed, you know, ADHD. And I also had some childhood health issues that were a real sort of struggle in terms of like being absent a lot and having sort of my mind on other places. And so, I mean, I hated school. Like I went to public school my whole life and, you know, in a nice area. So they were nice schools, but I joke around with my kids. The world was different, you know, back then. Again, I grew up in a really nice area. I think it was really nice, but you know, there was a fist fight every single day. Not I wasn't involved with any of that, but it was close enough that it was like, there was a fear, you know, with school. And so I just absolutely hated it. And the trajectory, you know, I graduated high school and everything, but I remember when I graduated, you know, sort of a 4-year college was sort of like out of the question. And my dad had grown up really poor and was the only person in his family to ever have gone to college. And so I'm sure he was like super sort of like, oh boy, you know, like we're not making progress here. You know, this isn't what I anticipated. I remember he would get Christmas cards from, you know, his friends. He worked as an engineer for the Department of Energy, and he would get these Christmas cards. And, you know, it was like, our son, John, you know, got into Princeton, or like our son, Eric, is going into the Navy. And, you know, and I was like, gosh, I wonder what my dad's card says. Like, my son, Ben, is a real fun guy and he's having some issues right now. So, yeah, so I didn't do well. And I really did not see a sort of a path, you know, forward there. And when I graduated, I took sort of like a gap year where I was working at a bike shop, you know, sort of a manager. And then I took classes at a community college. And, you know, at some point, you know, things started to change where I started to, you know, sort of, you know, kind of get my shit together. And, you know, I think there was some recognition like, okay, I'm more attentive in the morning. So I'm going to take classes when I can, kind of mid-morning. Then I'm going to go to work. I started to realize like it took me longer to kind of, you know, to read whatever the material was that we had to. But, you know, so allocating enough time there. I remember sort of learning that, you know, for me, like note-taking. I don't even think I took notes in high school. But in the college classes, I remember if I took notes like verbatim, like wrote down as much as I could and then would review the notes. Like if I made index cards before, you know, all the freshman class, you know, where you're memorizing stuff, I could memorize things really well as long as I wrote it all out and did it like on the index cards. So all that I ended up sort of kind of turning the corner. And then I went to a high university, transferred to high university. And then I had almost a dip where when you transfer to these schools, you register last. So even though I had some credits, I registered after everyone else. So like, I remember I had history at like 7:30 in the morning, you know, on the other side of campus. And OU is the type of town where you walk, you know, you walk to class, no one's driving. And I had the fake ID. So, and in Athens, Ohio, probably to this day, everything costs nothing. So like a, you know, pitcher of beer is like $4, you know, it's ridiculous. So early classes, fake ID, new, you know, trying to make friends. I remember being on academic probation, like the first year that I went to OU. My dad, again, was paying out of state tuition, was probably like, what the F is wrong with you? But then again, I went through this period where once I could register with everyone else and I got out of the dorms, you know, I moved into an apartment. That was a game changer. I mean, you know, studying in the dorms, I found really challenging. There's just always a distraction. But again, once I could do my own schedule, there was that. And I started, you know, of course, getting into the upper level classes where everything started switching, you know, for everyone listening, you know, somewhere in the 90s, like group projects became this big thing. Companies must have gone to colleges and said, we need people graduating to be really comfortable working in a team environment, a group environment. So everything became group projects. And as soon as everything became group projects, it was like all of a sudden, I did have a handful of superpowers that in History 100, if you're a great presenter, it's worth zero, right? But in like Management 300, where you get assigned to do a case study on Xerox with four other people and two of them are deathly afraid of speaking, it was like, all of a sudden it was like, hey, I'm a great presenter and I'm happy to do the presentation and I'll build the PowerPoint. Just get me the actual like written material. And then it's again, as soon as people would see you in action, then the next group project where there was the ability to self-select, you know, I think then you start getting in better groups because people are like, hey, we'll have that dude present. And this lady's great with the number crunching. And then that, of course, I think is much more like the real world. You know, it's like my first jobs as a salesperson. It's like, you know, what are you really good at? It's like, well, great. I can get a job where that's like almost all I do is what I'm really good at.
You opted into your strengths. And then the other theme that sounds like is being in an environment where you had a lot more independence, where it wasn't just this sort of rote approach to education, where you had some ability to self-create sort of the experience that you were driving for and have the ability to pick and choose how you went about it.
I do terribly with being told, you know, what to do. Like I remember even sort of telling my business partner when we were in the early, you know, first couple years, I mean, first year, like losing money. And I remember saying I was going away for Thanksgiving and I was going to leave on Wednesday, of course, Thursday, Thanksgiving, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and I was going to be gone the whole time. And, you know, he's 18 years my senior, and he was my boss before we started the company. So there was always this sort of alpha, you know, the big dog and me. And I remember him saying, I had like 4 employees or something. And I said, I was packing up on Wednesday, and he's like, where are you going? And I said, oh, I'm going to go to my parents' farmhouse for Thanksgiving. And he's like, when we're losing money and, you know, with everything the way that it is, that's what, you know, that's a great idea. You know, it's like that kind of thing. And I remember going home and telling my wife, like, I don't think I can go, you know, the farm. Like, Bob is pissed and like thinks I need to be, you know, basically on, you know, on all weekend. And, you know, years later, he would said, like, I didn't say that, or, you know, I was joking around with you. I was busting your chops. But I mean, I took it as he was like a mentor. I took it seriously. But I remember kind of saying to him, you know, in some follow up, like, I can work around the clock. But the minute you tell me, like, I have to be there, it's like, I'll just quit. I'll do my own motivation thing. Yeah. So having that agency, you know, I think is was a big thing. And one other sort of tie into the sort of your strengths. I think, you know, there are a lot of people that sort of are of this belief, like, you know, you kind of work on your weaknesses. Like with cycling, that was like the big thing. Like you're a sprinter, a climber, you know, breakaway person, you know, you have some strength. And I was always good on the breakaway side of things, kind of sustained power. And so the idea was like, if you're not good at sprinting, you should work on your weakness. And I had a coach early on who was like, if you're like going to the Tour de France, you know, you have to be, your weaknesses have to be shored up to some degree. That's never going to be you, right? You're like 28 years old or whatever. Like you're doing this for fun. So your best, you're like almost, you know, if we mapped out your power across different durations, this is where you have the opportunity to shine. These other places, no matter how hard you work at it, you're going to be dead. Not going to be good. And so I never did sprint training. It was always working on my strengths. And I think on the school side of things and the business side of things, it was a little bit similar. It was like, I'm not going to try to build, you know, complicated databases and spreadsheets. And, you know, like I built websites in the early days. I learned CSS and HTML. But it was like very obvious, we need to hire someone to do this. Because I can go out and sell, whereas we can hire someone who can, you know, code up these basic websites.
Right. Find your comparative advantages and exploit
exactly.
them.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, you've mentioned a number of times now your business partner and mentor, Bob, who I know you think incredibly highly of. And I think that's the next place I'd like to go in the conversation. You know, you talked about some early sales jobs in Chicago. Then you and your wife decided to move back to the DC area, closer to where you grew up and your family was. Then you went to work for Bob and then you became business partners. So how did it come to be that you two got together like that?
You know, I the story gets kind of blurred around in my head, you know, as I think back to it. You know, when I started my career, I worked for hotjobs.com, you know, it was the highflying.com. You know, I thought I was going to, you know, make tons of money by stock options. And, you know, so excited about all this. Stock options ended up being worth, they were underwater, you know, when Hot Jobs was acquired. Then I went to WorldCom and, you know, I thought, oh, I'm going to have this career in big technology. And then I took this, then WorldCom, the whole WorldCom fiasco happened. And all of a sudden I found myself saying, you know, like, I don't think I can handle, you know, another one of these. You know, Hot Jobs was acquired and kind of went all over the place. And then WorldCom, that whole thing happened. And so I sort of went on this boondoggle into small business, you know, sort of the small business world. And that's got me from Chicago back to DC. And then through that job, I met a guy who is one of Bob's first employees, a guy named Phil Koop. And Phil is also like in just, I only knew Phil for a brief period of time because he moved to Maine, which is why, you know, he called me up and said, hey, you should come and interview for my job. You know, I'm from Maine. I've been working here, but I'm moving back to Maine with my wife. It's where her family's from as well. And I remember thinking like, I do not want to, this is not the direction I had anticipated for my career. You know, like, I was working for this advertising company. Now I'm going to go work for a bottled water delivery company, like a local bottled water delivery company. were one of their advantages when I would say to like Bob, like, what makes your your water better? You know, he would say, you know, one of the things he said was like, one of the advantages was we're local. I was like, that is the, you know, I'm coming from like hot jobs in WorldCom. It's like technology and, you know, patents. And it's like, we're local. People want to work with a local company. I'm like, oh God. But Phil convinced me, you know, to come in and meet Bob, like in an interview kind of setting. And Bob is, you know, to this day, I think Bob is, you know, easily one of the, you know, top three smartest guys, you know, I know. And he's like very sort of, in one sense, he's kind of unassuming. Like in the interview, you know, he had a baseball hat on and a Drink More Water t-shirt, you know, tucked into khaki shorts with no belt. And I remember all this because one year I convinced the whole inside office team to dress up as Bob for Halloween, where we wore these boat shoes. He always wore boat shoes. And then these khaki shorts with a Drink More Water shirt tucked in and a long sleeve shirt underneath, and then a Duke hat. He went to Duke for his undergrad. So, you know, Phil is what got me connected to Bob. And then, like I said, early in the interview process, when we were just doing this sort of, hey, like, where'd you grow up? Are you from the area? You know, and I told him where I went to high school and stuff. And that's, he said, is your mom Helen Landers? Like, I think she taught my kids at St. Elizabeth's. And of course, I knew where she worked and stuff. And so, you know, he thought the world of, you know, of my mom as, you know, in terms of how she treated his kids. And so anyway, that's sort of what led to us, you know, connecting. And then in many ways, Bob was like, we're very similar in some ways and completely different others. Like Bob was, he went to Georgetown Prep, you know, went to all these private schools growing up. His dad was an attorney. And so, you know, he was like a pedigree guy, all these, you know, Georgetown Prep, Duke, engineering degree at Duke, Schlumberger, you know, as a young engineer, and then to Harvard Business School, you know, where I was like public high school, barely graduated, community college. I'm not even sure I told him that. And then Ohio University, you know, tier three, you know, public college. And it took me like 5.5 years to, you know, get out. And Bob was, you know, whereas I was probably the last kid in high school done with the math test, Bob was the first one done. You know, just always the guy who, you know, he could do, he would laugh, you know, if he heard this, but like, to me, he could do these like ridiculously complicated math problems, you know, in his head, like in no time. Just one of those people that's conversant with numbers, fractions, decimals, huge numbers, dividing, percentages, analogies based off of the numbers, you know, whereas I'm like, you know, and he used to sort of whip that stuff out to me. And I remember once Bob was also into cycling. I remember kind of saying to him, like, we've known, you know, this after we had known each other for a while, I'm like, Bob, like, clearly you have a gift, right? But what annoys me is that you pretend that I'm bad at math compared to you because I'm not trying. I said, just think of it like this. I can put out more power with one leg on a bike than you can with both legs. And yes, I've like trained and stuff, but the reality is I was born with that gift. So what if I rode alongside you with one leg and said, come on, Bob, like just try harder. You know, it's like, give me a break. But we're different in one sense, but we're very similar. Like he's a high passion guy. You know, there's sort of one Bob. There isn't like a business Bob and then a personal Bob. And I'm kind of that way. I'm the way that I am in all aspects of my life. He's that way. He's, you know, really funny guy, always working humor into everything. I would say a kind and generous, you know, he talked to like, whether it was a warehouse person working for him, the stewardess on a, you know, airline flight attendant, he treated everyone, you know, like, you know, sort of like they were, you know, VIP. And he was super argumentative. Like he's sort of a, like, it took me a while to figure out that the path was like, all right, in this relationship, Bob's the big dog. He's the boss. I'm the former, you know, underling. He's right. I'm wrong. He's smart. I'm dumb. So all I really have to do is whatever I want to have happen, it has to come from him. It has to be his idea. So if I said like, this is probably like a really dumb idea and I would throw it out there, he would then argue why, well, that's not a dumb idea. Why would you say that? You know, you always do that. And then he'd argue for it. And, you know, once I had that little number, we bought a phone system. Like you'll love this, Tim. We bought a phone system and, you know, we got into a size where we were outgrowing our phone system. So we bought this fancy phone system And the guys who sold us the phone system said, you know, it's going to cost $2,000 to wire up your office to put the Ethernet ports in. You know, these are voice over IP phones. And Bob, I brought back the proposal, and, you know, I would run bigger investments past Bob. And I said, hey, you know, this is the proposal. You know, do we lease or do we buy? And then it's going to cost two G's just to wire up the office. And he's like, that's ridiculous. I'm going to wire up the office. Right. And so we had ordered the phones and they were going to come in like 3 or 4 weeks, and weeks are going by. And, you know, Bob is running another company. He's running the water company. So it's like my admin is like, when is Bob going to, the phones are going to be here like next week, and we need the ports and we haven't even started. And I would go up and kind of nag Bob. And like, he'd say, I'll do it. I'm busy. You know, I'm doing other stuff. And I'm like, I get it, but I need you to like do this. And finally, I went up to his office and I said, you know, I talked to the phone guys today, and the phone guy was sort of giving me crap. He said, you know, I told you that water guy, like when I told him that you were going to do it instead of pay them, he said, who's going to do it? And I said, you know, the guy that owns the water company. And he said, I told you that water guy, we could never do that. Like, why? That's like the dumbest thing ever. The guy, the bottled water guy, is going to wire your office. And Bob hears that and was like, the Ethernet was in like, you know, the next day. And then when the phone guys are there installing it, the technician's there, and Bob like walks up to him and he like puts his arm around him and he's like, Mike, you know, you thought that this was over my pay grade. Like, you tell me this isn't the best, you know, cleanest installation you ever seen. And he didn't know what Bob was talking about. He was like, and I just remember thinking like, oh, well.
That's great. I mean, we could probably have a whole show just about your relationship with Bob, but I know you learned and so much from him and took away so many lessons. What are like a couple of the top ones that sort of have had the most impact on you?
Yeah, probably number one is Bob was a big, you know, he ran his business, the bottled water business, sort of open book management. I mean, he went to business school when kind of open book was becoming a big thing, you know, the Great Game of Business, all that kind of stuff. For those who are listening, if you haven't read the Great Game of Business, it's a fantastic business book. And the idea is like, you know, business is a game, it's a team sport. And by sharing data and numbers and how the company's doing, how the business is doing, the key metrics with employees, you know, they're empowered and people start to really see how they impact the business. So he was always a sort of think like the owner of a business. So he would always, when I worked for him, and I was sort of trying to come up with make a decision or had an idea, he would just say like, Ben, if you own the business 100%, what would you do? Or, you know, he went on vacation once and I hadn't been there all that long. And I said, there's a lot of stuff we haven't covered. I'm like your vice president. And he said, just pretend it's your company. Whatever you think is right. Like, you know, you and I probably are not going to agree on everything, but like if someone walks in the front office and the receptionist isn't there and the person just standing there, right? If it's your company, what are you going to do? I'm like, you know, I would walk up and say to him, you know, hey, you know, do you have an appointment or who are you here to see? Can I get you a cup of coffee? He's like, just do that. So that think and act like an owner mentality. And that became sort of one of the big key differentiators in the culture of Blue Corona was, you know, sort of we treat Blue Corona like it's like each person, like treat it like you own the company. And we also think like the owners of our clients' businesses. So, you know, the typical agency, the client gives them a budget of $2,500 for Google, you know, pay-per-click. And then the person managing the pay-per-click account sees that we're getting leads or sales for like a third of what the business owner is willing to pay, and they're hitting the budget. And so in a normal company, it's like, well, I was told their budget's this, they hit the budget. So like, I just went on to the next account. Like at Blue Corona, the deal would be like to tell the account manager, like I can get leads at way less than they're willing to pay, and we're hitting the budget halfway through the month. Talk to the client, let's up the budget. Like, and that was like a common thing. So that was a big thing from Bob. Bob was a measure everything and make data-driven decisions. So everything that can be quantified, quantify it, track it. And he really, I think, kind of applies that with everything, golf and his health and all that kind of stuff. It's like really looking at the data, not taking people's, you know, people's word for things. And I mean, even his business, the bottled water business, you know, you sort of commonly hear like tap water is fine. And he would sort of say, you know, 99.9% of all tap water is used for like you know, non-drinking. So when you think of like the cost benefit of the government deciding like how much do you want to pay to filter it, when most of it's like watering your lawn and flushing your toilet. So like that might be okay for you, but like what I put in my body, I'm going to remove as much as humanly possible in terms of impurities, lead, you know, things you can't get rid of. So make data-driven decisions was a big one. Bob was also, I remember being shocked when I first met him. You know, he was clearly extremely smart. He had gone to all these fancy schools. And I remember when we were starting, we had started a couple different businesses, but each time his like sending me out on the mission was to basically go online and look at what everyone else was doing and sort of put in a spreadsheet. So when Drink More Water had its first like e-commerce, you know, it was a brochure website and I built an e-commerce aspect of it. We, you know, he was like, go and see what Deer Park, Poland Spring, you know, Crystal Springs, like, let's see what every single person's doing and kind of look at it and steal from like, and I remember thinking like, you can't steal other people's stuff. And he was like, this isn't school. We're not like plagiarizing someone's homework. Like, of course we can steal it. We can steal anything we want, you know, like, and by the time we're done, you know, we've added a little bit of this and we've added a little bit of that. We added our own idea here. It always becomes your own thing. So kind of that steal it like an artist. He didn't recommend that book, but it is a great book. I remember thinking like, I thought like if you went to Harvard and you're super smart, I thought you just come up with your own, you know, idea. But I would say he almost never did things like where it was like, oh, I just had this out of the blue. It was like, I saw this company in Arizona doing this really cool thing. What if we did it here in Maryland? And then the one other thing I was thinking about, I guess two other things that I got from him that I think have really helped me a lot was sort of, I don't know what he would call it. I sort of used to think that like at infinity, the answer is easy. There's probably like an actual, you know, thing here. But, you know, like if you have a business and you're like, you know, like we want to grow the business and we have a $20,000 marketing budget, you know, what should we do? Bob would look, change it around and say like, what if you had $1 million to grow the business? What would you do? And it almost always, you know, when you're dealing with like these 20,000 small number, it's like, oh, we'll do a little bit of this and we'll do a little bit of this and we'll do a little bit of this. It's sort of this incremental versus he would kind of use this extreme, like take it to the extreme. What would happen if we hired like 100 people like that and had them in a room doing X? How would that work? If Blue Corona was 100 times the size that it is today, what would you want, you know, how would that look or how would that work? And sort of a final one that it sort of really helped me was, I remember he overheard me when the business was probably had 20 or 30 people. And we were sort of going through that classic, you know, we're growing fast. We're like everything to me, it felt like the wheels are falling off the wagon. Like every day there's some fire. He overheard me. I was out front of our building talking to a high school friend of mine. And my high school friend was working for like Eli Lilly or someone as like a sales rep. And I remember I was telling him like, oh, it's a complete shit show over here. Like one of my key people just quit and this client wants to see me tomorrow. They're probably going to fire us. You know, I can't seem to get anything right. We're outgrowing our accounting system. You know, it's just one complaint after the other. And then I was like, Bob, we shared an office. So I was in the downstairs. He was in the upstairs, but my mailbox and our controller was upstairs. And so I would kind of have to walk by his office to get to our controller and my mailbox. So like later that afternoon, I was walking to get our mail or something. And he said, hey, you know, who were you talking to on the phone earlier? And I said, oh, it's my high school buddy. And he's like, do me a favor. Next time you talk to him every day. I'm like, yeah, like every other day. He's like, next time you talk to him, tell him everything's going fantastically. We're growing like crazy. I can't hire people fast enough. We have like, you know, clients are killing it. Like we're doing great work. You know, all these things that were true, but just tell him that. Because, you know, when you go through and like just reinforce, like every business has all the problems that you were bitching to your buddy about. The difference is like when you focus on those problems, like that's all, and it's like your life becomes what you basically point your attention to. So if you point it to like, we're growing fast and we're doing great and we're, you know, hiring, and we're all these great things. It just, it's like creates like a, you know, sort of a vicious cycle where things get better and better. But if all you ever do is focus on the problems, that's all that's going to happen. And it's just going to trip you up and suck the energy out of you. Your body will think your business sucks. And so I remember, like, I don't think it was that one conversation that changed it, but I do remember, you know, sort of that, like having sort of this epiphany that you can control your focus. And at any given time, like in your personal life and your work, there are going to be problems and issues and challenges. And there are also all sorts of great things, you know, going on. And again, your life really does become just sort of what you choose to focus on. You know, that was a game changer for me. And, you know, of course, I try to teach the employees that, you know, we'd have an employee that, you know, inevitably coming out of college, you know, had never worked, you know, for a company before, you know, where the pace is getting to them, or, you know, a client would get mad at an account manager and, you know, they'd get all bummed out. And so helping them sort of reframe, you know, reframe things, just always reframing whatever the situation was for, like, what's the most productive interpretation of what just happened, and just developing that as a habit. Ironically, since I sold the business, I was just thinking about it as a lead up to talking to you that for whatever reason, that's like, I almost stopped doing that for temporarily when we sold. And like, remember thinking like, gosh, all that stuff that I used to sort of do religiously because of the business, like, God, I need to keep doing all that stuff as it relates to my personal life.
Yeah. Great learning. Selling the business is the last part of our conversation I want to touch on. So it wasn't that long ago, you had a very successful growth story with Blue Corona, found a buyer, and then made the transition out of the business, certainly the day-to-day operations, pretty quickly. And I'm just, it's a pretty fascinating next chapter, I think, to be in that space where, you know, you've been so driven and worked so hard, and it actually worked and it came together. And, you know, you had the opportunity to sort of take some chips off the table and rethink how you want to spend the next, you know, couple decades of your life. And so to start, like, just how's that going?
I kind of feel like I'm, you know, like bipolar. One side of it is it's absolutely amazing. I almost feel guilty saying, like, talking about how amazing it is, because I just feel like anyone who's still working, you know, it's like painful to hear. We were on vacation last week, you know, my extended family, and my brother-in-law said, "Ben, what's your next week look like?" And I said, "Exactly like this, but just not at the beach. Instead, I'll have, you know, golf course in my backyard." So it's really great. I mean, I kind of like what we've talked about earlier, where I was sort of like this binary off on. I mean, when I had the company, we started the company in 2007, 2008. I worked 7 days a week, literally, you know, all the time, you know, getting to the office 5 or 6 in the morning, leaving. I always tried to be one of the last people to leave, just for, out of principle. It's kind of stupid, but I did, till like 2015. And then we got sort of big enough where I started like saying, like, you know, it's not the greatest look to be, you know, running myself ragged. And so then I started working a little bit more, you know, taking vacations and stuff like that. But I was all in with the company. And one other thing from Bob is, you know, when I met Bob, in the interview, he said, you know, "Where do you want to be in 5 years? You know, what does, like, success look like? What's your number?" Like, we talked about that in the interview. And I remember him saying, like, if I had $10 million, I would sell the business and mountain bike, golf, you know, hang out, like, for the rest of my life. And I remember thinking sort of the same way. Like, we had this idea with starting Blue Corona to build it up, make it a great business, and eventually have someone who would want to buy it. And that was the idea, was that, like, hey, I said to my wife, like, "What's your earliest memory? You know, like, how old were you?" She's like, "I don't know. Like, I kind of remember like my 8th or 9th birthday, but like, I don't really have clear like memories till I'm like, you know, maybe 11 or 12, you know, where it's like really consistent." I said, "Yeah, me too." So I basically have, like, our son was born 2007. I basically have till 2017. He's not going to remember a thing. he won't know whether I was here, whether I wasn't here, all that stuff. And let's be honest, you add all the good stuff to the kids, and I basically come home and take away, I put bad habits, goofing off with them. So I say all that in that now, having exited, part of the motivation was to be ever present, so like taking the kids to school, going to all, I always went to their games and stuff, but like really being there sort of for them. And, and just, I see them a ton, which is, amazing.
Yeah. Those are the obvious upsides. I think control of your schedule, the ability to be at leisure when you want to pick and choose where you want to exert yourself, the time with the family, obviously. What have been some of the challenges that you've come up with the new lifestyle and position?
Well, yeah, and it's interesting because I guess I'm at that point where I sort of recognize, I'll sort of bumble this out. There's a more articulate way to say it, but I get into the, first of all, when you're the CEO of a company of any size, there's some importance that comes with that. You're introduced that way even when you don't want to be. People invite you to games. They want, they send you stuff like, hey, a new restaurant's opening. Here's like four, free meals, but bring your team. Part of your identity becomes I'm a CEO, I'm in this company and, I'm some of importance. And, when you sell the business, I think there's some idea that like, I'm going from CEO to where now I'm like a, fairly high net worth, individual. I'm like, that's important. But that you sort of want to, in many ways, you sort of want to keep it like anonymous. Like, it's not like you're walking around, advertising that, at least I don't, I drive the same car I've always had and, upgraded the house, but it's nothing crazy. And so you lose that platform. That was the other thing I thought is like my kids came to like take your kid to, work day. And like I brought my son on New Year's Day to the office where I was doing like planning. And he was, of course, like right drawing pictures on the whiteboard or whatever. But like my kids wouldn't have been old enough. Like when I gave a all company presentation, for the new year kickoff or something like that, like this is our plan for the year. Here's our strategy. Like now, and sort of seeing me in action. Whereas like my son now at 16 and my daughter at 14, I think they would have really gotten a kick out of that. And so I don't have that. So I didn't appreciate that. Like I don't have a platform like that anymore. That's one aspect of the other aspect of it is just, as sort of a competitive person, I always wanted to grow the business. And sometimes I wanted to grow the business just because it's like, I want to get Blue Chrono to 100 million revenue. And it's like, why? It's like, I don't know, because that's bigger than this competitor who we hate them. Like we want to be better and bigger and, than them. And of course I recognize that sort of this playing these status games of like, bigger company, more revenue, better car, fancier house, none of it, it makes you happier. And in fact, it probably has the opposite effect. But I would say, that's of course continues to be, when you're surrounded by people who are still working, it's like when you have the friend who gets the job at the, the company that then IPOs and now they've got $50 million and you're suddenly looking at your pile going like, gosh, I want that. Like I want more. But then I'm old enough to, or smart enough, wise enough to realize that, that's just the endless, like just getting off of that. But I do struggle with that. When people who are still in their sort of peak earning, are having these things happen to them and you think to yourself, like, gosh, should I really be like, it's like the, what is it, the John Lennon watching the wheels go round and round? It's sort of this like, the game is going on and I'm not in it. And every now and then there's this. But I got to say that the enlightened part of me or the Zen part of me says that's all like a facade.
Yeah. Changing into this new role after the sale is kind of like finding yourself in a new job and there's no instruction manual there. Did you turn to anybody for guidance about settling into what you're doing, or did it just sort of like just experimentation and figured out eventually like this is the rhythm that feels good right now?
Yeah, it's. I guess I'll answer that in a couple different ways. I mean, I was in YPO and I was in Vistage when we sold, and then when I was newly exited. And I thought that I would get what you're talking about from those groups. And the weirdest thing happened, like in my YPO group, and it's all like super confidential, so I won't get into like names or hints of who's who, but in my group, I was the youngest person by, you know, probably 10 years, just worked out that way. And we would go to schedule our monthly meeting. And my calendar, of course, is like wide open. And these guys' calendars, like it would take us an hour just to get like a time that would work for eight guys. And so you would think that there was some part of them that they have more money than they could ever spend, more success than they could ever have imagined. They don't need to keep working. I mean, they're 10 years older than I am. I'm 48. And so you would think that that group would say like, yeah, I really need to like think, you know, I would tell them how I spent, you know, my last month and how great it was. And they would say like, man, that sounds fantastic. But then they would immediately sort of like, Ben, what are you going to do next? Like you're not going to just keep doing that. Like you got to do something. And it was like, why? So I didn't find like when I would talk to entrepreneurs, almost everyone that I know that exited couldn't stay out. They almost immediately jumped into something else. I do have one friend who was a Blue Corona client who had an HVAC company with two partners. They sold it. And I go to lunch with him on a pretty regular basis. And we have some of the same conversations, which is he has a desire to do something. But then he sits and it's like, you know, dude, I made 20 grand today, like just doing nothing, watching the money grow. Why? And I find myself saying, why would I want to go do this thing? And I'm like, I'm right there with you. I mean, I don't, you know, why are we feeling this way type of thing? So there's that. But the other thing I was going to say is one of the things that I struggled with just, but very briefly, when I sort of was a CEO, you know, there are people that like, are professional CEOs, like they're groomed to become the CEO, like maybe of a family business, or they go to school and the private equity firm puts them in as a CEO. And then there's the founder who becomes the CEO of an ever-increasing business. And it's almost like you didn't plan for it. It's accidental. And I think the CEO job is very nebulous, can be very nebulous, depending on the industry and the company and the situation. You get to decide how you spend your time. I mean, unless, you know, if you don't have a board and all that stuff. And so when I was the CEO of the company, I almost sort of invented a little system. It's like kind of created my own sort of construct. Like, how do I do innovation? Or like, how do I get customer, you know, feedback? Like, how can I sort of mechanize it? And I had a spreadsheet and a PowerPoint, and that was like my whole, and my Outlook. And that was like my little business system. And I, in many ways, I've done the same thing with this. I mean, I have a PowerPoint, which is sort of like my kind of like visual, like things that I'm thinking about, investments, health, my family. And then I got a spreadsheet and I got my Outlook. And so in many ways, it's sort of the same thing. I just try to think of it like I still, even though I don't have a job, quote unquote, I still wake up each morning and, you know, from, say, 6 a.m. to 10:30. I'm either reading or in front of the computer, you know, going, depends on the day,
yeah,
you know, the topic. The
schedule. But,
yeah. But I haven't found, kind of to your original question, I have not found anyone who's sort of living a parallel life. Almost everyone I know has sold and then they're immediately super busy again. I almost can't understand it. Because again, everything that I've sort of read is sort of like, I mean, you don't know how much time you have. You don't know how long, there's how long you're going to live. And then there's how long you're going to live where you're like got all your facility, you know, you're healthy and you can do the things that you want to do. I don't know. I just.
They probably can't understand your decision either. So it's probably a mutual level of confusion between you. But what would cause you, is there anything that would cause you to change your lifestyle at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I think if I couldn't, it, you know, it's funny when I first exited, you know, I of course got, you know, super, I started biking, you know, tons and hiking and lifting weights and playing golf and doing all this stuff. And it was kind of funny. You know, I'm like, all of a sudden I'm at the doctor's all the time And, you know, it's like my left knee and now my right knee and my shoulder. And I got this problem with my wrist. And I'm like saying this, you know, my doctor's like around our age. And he's like, well, what are you doing, you know, each week? And I'm like telling him, and he's like, you can't do that. Like the warranty ends at 40. You can't bike 20 hours a week. And I mean, of course you can, but you know, he's like, you have to be different as like, and so one thing that would change, like I didn't bike or do much of anything, but I played a little bit of golf when I was building the company, hiked and played a little bit of golf. And it's funny, all my hikes, I would always listen to an Audible business book. So I, you know, it's like always in the mode, but I think if I couldn't, if something happens to my health, you know, where I can't spend, you know, 3 to 5 hours a day sort of outside, then I would go back and kind of treat business like a sport. I do find it like incredibly fun. And I have a ton of fun. Like I will have, you know, like a CEO or entrepreneur, you know, will call me or find me or look me up, or, you know, either they have a similar business or a completely different business. And, you know, every time I have those calls, it's like it's super invigorating. And it always is like, I want to hire you. I want to pay you, you know, to do X or to do Y. And I always think to myself, like, I don't really want that. Like, you can call me whenever you want. Well, I know you're really busy. It's like, no, I'm not busy at all. But like, it's in the minute there's like a paycheck or a scope or a statement of work, you know, then it's like, I'm going to deliver it. You know, I'm not going to leave you hanging, but I also don't really want that. I can hop on the phone at, you know, for an hour at 7 at night, but I don't want to be like, have to come in and do something. So if what would change is if I couldn't enjoy sort of the things that I'm doing, you know, recreationally outside, then I would go back into like the game of business, I think. Or if something happened where, like, you and I have talked about this a little bit, and I'm really kind of really, I don't know if envy is the right, because I don't know enough about a situation, but, you know, Andrew from Tiny, you know, it's a sort of love this idea of having like a holding company where you have all these investments and you have a relationship with the companies as an investor, you know, and sort of like on a board, but, you know, something like that would be fantastic, but it's, you know, it's just, I'm probably not there yet.
And I also think my work to get there.
Yeah, a lot of work to get there. And I don't know that, you know, I mean, I don't know that people don't want recreational, you know, board members. They want people who are like kind of all in. And the other thing I've seen about is one of my current like struggles or things that I try to navigate through, which is my sort of strong suit is probably as a startup CEO. I mean, I can do a lot of different things, you know, at a reasonable level. Like my weaknesses in the small business world are not, you know, I can kind of do everything, or I can find people that can do the stuff. Whereas like when Blue Corona got to a certain size, I brought in like a real executive team. And one of the guys that I brought in, who now is the CEO of the entire, you know, holdco that bought us, he's like, you know, kind of your, he's not lazy, but, you know, so sort of like the smart lazy person. Like he is not going to do the on the ground work. He's going to define or work with someone to define what it is. And then they're going to go do it. And he's going to, you know, oversee it. But he is, when the business got to a certain size where it was just always felt to me like, you know, a fishing, you know, like where all the line is just everywhere. And I just couldn't untangle it. He was the best I've ever seen at sort of asking questions to kind of parse away the noise and really get to the heart of it. And then find like, who is the leader that's going to kind of define what excellence looks like? And then taking these little steps, a little bit better, a little bit better, a little bit. Whereas I would say like, Mike, this is still like all screwed up. You know, this is a mess. And he was like, buddy, like, you got to get out of my, like, you got to get out of my hair. Like, you're like a perfectionist. Like, you want it all done tomorrow. That's not how this is going to work. So he had that strength of like, if he was the top of a holdco and had all these little portfolio companies with a million different issues, he would be fantastic at sort of, you know, sort of getting each of the CEOs like off on their, you know, and serving as that guiding light. Whereas I would be like jumping into holdco and like fixing their marketing plan or something.
Right. Yeah.
Which is a huge mistake. you know, maybe good in the short term, but
different kinds of leaders required for different kinds of situations.
Right. Right.
As the wrap up to all this, given everything about your life's journey so far, what aspect of it has been most surprising to you? Like when you were, you know, starting out as a kid and imagining what life would end up like, you know, what was unimaginable then that has actually come to pass?
I mean, it's again, it's sort of self-deprecating, but, you know, I was so disruptive, you know, sort of had so many struggles as a kid between school, behavior, health, you know, all those three. And, you know, you and I talked about it briefly, and I sort of said I didn't want to get into all of it, but, you know, I had these childhood health issues that were, to me, were catastrophic. Maybe to someone else, they'd say, oh, that's not that big of a deal. To me, it was a big deal. And it carried on forever in my mind. And so if you had said, you know, that I was going to graduate from college, have anything resembling a successful career, that would have been like unimaginable. To say like, you know, they'd be running a company, successful company, win all these awards, have really smart people, way smarter than me, working for me, and then exiting, you know, all the employees, when they heard that we're exiting, the, you know, as we told them, it was like, oh, private equity, they say one thing and they do another. The company that acquired us did every single thing they said they were going to do, and then some. Like, they did better than what they said. And that's not what I had heard from any of the YPO, Vistage, you know. It was always horror stories. So that's the big thing. It's like, I want to go on like a speaking trip where I say like, if I can do it with this IQ, these grades, all of these impediments, you can do anything, you know, but of course it's never comes off, you know, that way. Like, it's just a joke with my wife. Like, our kids are so much smarter than we are. It's almost like we just spend most of the day hiding how, you know, how much worse we were than they. And like, people are like, your kids are so great. How did you do that? And we're like, we don't know. That's what's so scary. We don't know what, going back to the data, we don't know what part of our recipe caused this and what part they just dealt with. So we don't know what to change. We basically just try to stay.
Well, that what a blessing though, that they ended up like that, however they got there. And I think what a testament to your whole journey and sort of the place where you've ended up is a testament, I think, to the notion of perseverance, right? And there's a resiliency there that I think in the conversations that I've had so far with this podcast is actually one of the recurring themes that's coming up. You know, people from all different starting points in life, this notion that hard work trumps talent and the fact that people just don't quit and they keep going seems to be one of the commonalities across all these people so far, which I think is pretty fascinating.
I was in a fraternity in college, and one of the one of the best things that came out about, you know, besides the relationships, was Calvin Coolidge was one of our, you know, like fraternity brothers. And so we all had to memorize the persistence poem. So it's sort of this, nothing in the world can take the place of persistence. And, you know, and of course we would have, this was like pre, you know, hazing rules, where we would be like blindfolded and, you know, people throwing stuff at us, and we had to recite this poem. But I remember thinking about that all throughout, you know, my career and, you know, personal stuff. And, you know, I agree with you that it really is, you know, showing up and sort of continuing and sort of that this too shall pass, no matter what you're going through, it, you know, usually eventually gets better or ends.
Well, Ben, thank you for the conversation. This was awesome. I really enjoyed it. And I'm extremely grateful that you took the time to share all these experiences with me.
Thanks for having me, Tim. It's been a pleasure.
If you enjoyed today's episode, you can find transcripts and show notes at transitionspodcast.com. Please also feel free to share this episode on your favorite podcast player with friends and colleagues who might share an interest in exploring the most critical moments from the lives of today's business leaders.